Good evening. Welcome to the Just Sleep Podcast. I'm Tayshia, your host. Every week, I will read you an old story to help you relax, put the stressful day behind you, and drift off to sleep. Occasionally, we will run ads in order to cover the costs of the production of the podcast. Rest assured, there will be no ads during or after the story. If you prefer an ad-free and intro-free show, you can join Just Sleep Premium. Visit justsleeppodcast.com/support for more information.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tonight, I read short stories by Elizabeth Banks, Catherine Mansfield, and Willa Cather. So lie down, close your eyes, and let me read you a story. The Woman Who Was So Tired by Elizabeth Banks. The assistant editor wanted a story with human interest in it, so he looked around for the little reporter. She came whirling in on the wings of the revolving door, dancing on her toes to keep up a circulation, her fingers wiggling within her muff, her veil dotted with frozen breath and teardrops. "My, it's cold," she piped, "and so glassy. I slipped twice getting here from the elevator." Throwing her frosted muff and coat on her roll-top desk, she lovingly hugged the radiator, holding in her half-numbed fingers the morning paper while she scanned the headlines. They called her the little reporter because she was no bigger than your thumb and because she belonged to that particular type of woman which always appeals to the male heart as needing to be taken care of. "Yes," said the assistant editor, "it is cold. And the weather has made me think of a story for you. New York must be full of suffering of one kind and another on a day like this. Just go out and spend it looking for the coldest woman in New York, or the saddest woman, or the most overworked woman, or the most anything woman in New York, and come back and write a story about her. So the little reporter drew on her coat again and dried her veil and wrapped it around her face and skipped blithely out by the circling door into the sleet. And late that night she limped back again and sat at her desk and wrote a story, and she called it The Woman Who Was So Tired. While the assistant editor read the copy, it was noticed that he used his handkerchief freely while swearing at whoever it might be who insisted upon fresh air from an open window. "And me, coming down with this cold in my head," muttered the assistant editor unsteadily. The story of the woman who was so tired made a hit. It was full of humor and a tender pathos that touched the heart. In it, the little reporter seemed to have given her readers of her best, that best which made the smile break through the shining tears like a sunburst through an April shower. People read, and as they read, they laughed with the woman who was so tired at the comedies in her daily life, while as quickly they wept over her tragedies. The woman who was so tired was described as young and self-supporting, and others supporting as well, for she had a mother who stopped at home and kept the flat between intervals of pain, two little sisters in the graded school, and a younger brother. To earn their several livings, the woman who was so tired had chosen a profession which made of her a wanderer in New York streets, among the rich, the poor, the moderately well-to-do. Did not one know without telling that she was a book canvasser or a seller of small wares at open doors? Doors that so often shut in her face ere she had stated her errand. All day she wandered among downtown offices, east side tenements, west side apartments, sometimes into shops on Fifth Avenue and Broadway, sometimes into those of humble, dirty side streets. Sometimes she searched for treasure among the garbage cans. There were days when, in connection with her own legitimate business, she would attempt to aid those who were in greater distress than herself. And on certain of these days, there were high-pitched voices that assailed her, and brooms held in filthy hands would also sweep her down a squalid five flights of stairs. The longer she worked, the better she was paid, for she worked not on a salary basis, but on a commission. Often, when in the worst neighborhoods of the East Side, she would go hungry all the day, not because she lacked the pennies for food, but because her capricious appetite revolted against the fare served in any of the nearby restaurants. She was often running to catch cars and trains, for minutes were precious to her, and she sometimes walked, seeking out her patrons, so she was always weary. And in writing of her, the little reporter had named her the woman who was so tired. At the newspaper office, they knew at once the story had made a hit because it brought in letters by the dozens. Kind-hearted philanthropists demanded to be given the real name and address of the woman who was so tired, for they knew she lived and moved among them every day, and that the author of the story had met her and known her well. She had gone to their hearts, and they wanted to do something for her. One saw the weary woman was proud, though poor. So the philanthropist declared they would help her without her knowing whence help came. New York working women wrote, thanking the author for her championship of women who had to work overtime, for the heroine had been described as often working 16 hours a day. Before the end of a week, the volume of correspondence concerning the story and its heroine so increased that now the little reporter had it heaped upon her desk in stacks, and presents began to arrive addressed to the woman who was so tired in care of the editor or the writer of the story. Checks came in, and the little reporter often gashed the palm of her hand with the pins that fastened dollar bills to notepaper, which was daintily written or ignorantly scrawled, a word of sympathy for the heroine of Roving Feet. There were presents of warm clothing, dress lengths, toys of various kinds for the little sisters and brother, a thin Colport cup and saucer for the invalid mother who, in the story, was always longing for the dainty surroundings of better days. There were books, some grave, some laughter-giving, all nicely bound, boxes of chocolate, packages of nuts. Very frequently now, the assistant editor would be called to the telephone to be asked for the address or further information of the woman who was so tired. and he grew irritable over the continual interruptions to his work. One might think, he said crossly, that nobody ever was tired before and never would be again. Great Scott, I'm tired myself. Here, he called to one of the office boys, take this batch of letters and presents over to Miss Sanderson's desk and tell her to call an expressman and forward them to that woman who was always tired. The little reporter looked up with a shrug of annoyance and protestation. Haven't you got her address? Asked the boy sympathetically. Then quickly he added, of course not. She wouldn't give that, I guess, after all she told you. They began to notice about the office that the little reporter in her corner was losing somewhat of her blithe look and manner. Her cheeks were paling and her eyes saddened and took on the look that comes of little sleep. In and out of the office, then intermittently at her desk, on which there now was scarce space for the moving of her pen, she worked on as was her custom, taking an assignment first here, then there. But her cheery laugh was now infrequent, and only occasionally now came a flash of wit in her hurried conversations with the different members of the staff. They tried to joke her about the heroine of her story, but she failed to respond with her old-time lightning-like repartee. So those cuts have come at last, exclaimed the assistant editor one afternoon, as a messenger boy bore toward him an oblong cardboard box. He stretched out his hands for it. For the woman who was so tired, please forward. This was the inscription on the attached label and on the box in gold letters, Blank & Company Florists, Broadway. Hang the woman who was so tired, he cried out angrily. Then pointing to the desk where sat the little reporter, he added a bit softly, take him over to that lady. She drew out from the box a dozen American Beauty roses, and hanging to the wide ribbon which bound their stems was a card. It read, From a tired man to a tired woman. She put them in the ice water jug. They were beautiful roses and costly, and they shone out gloriously from among the heaps of parcels and letters addressed to the woman who was so tired. The little reporter's fingers trembled on her pencil, and a drop splashed down upon the yellow copy paper. For a moment, her hand pressed her temple, then she dropped her face in her hands. The assistant editor walked over to her. Are you ill, Miss Sanderson? He asked kindly. No, she drawled. I hope you haven't had bad news. No, she said again. It's just about that woman who was so tired. It's on my conscience. I can't sleep, I... Nearly she broke down. Her eyes were growing bigger and rounder. All these letters, these bundles, these roses. I didn't think it would turn out like this. How could I know people would go on so? I had to get a story. I couldn't waste all that time. I hunted and searched till 9 o'clock that night, and I just... It is useless for you to say you made it up, interrupted the assistant editor. I know it's true. Everybody knows it's true. I didn't make it up. It was all true. Oh, don't you understand? I was it. Her face went down among the roses and the parcels. The assistant editor gazed sturdily about the room, yet seeing none of the rush and turmoil connected with getting out the next morning's paper, hearing none of the click of the typewriters, nor the din of telegraph tables. And this was the woman who was so tired. Their little reporter, who went in and out among them, apparently so unconsciously cheerful, so full of the joy of life and work, calling out sometimes when she had finished two columns, find me something else so I can run up a nice space bill this week. His mind travelled over the details of the story that had stirred so many hearts. The woman had appeared to be a book canvasser working on commission. How like a reporter working on space and scouring the town for news. Frail and young, she had a whole family of dependents. In the story, she had gone out in the ice and sleet, had slipped 3 times and turned her ankle. Instinctively, he looked at the little reporter's feet and noticed that she was wearing odd boots, the one boot much larger than the other, doubtless because of the swelling of her strained ankle. Why? On the night of the day when he had sent her out, had she not returned laughing and limping? He looked out of the window, out over the towering skyscrapers of Great New York. where daily he had sent her to bring in news of the city's joys and sorrows, its weddings and its funerals, its prayers and its cursings, its virtue and its vice, its feastings and its fasting. Great heavens! The woman who was so tired was often hungry. Had the little reporter ever lacked for food? Involuntarily, his eye traveled back to her desk and rested upon the large printed quotation one of the men reporters suggestingly hung above it, the morning they had published her particularly racy and sparkling account of a banquet at Sherry's. Who gives the fine report of the feast? She who got none and enjoyed it least. For 3 years now, the little reporter had been on his staff, the one woman among a dozen men. He had hesitated about taking her on. She had seemed so tiny, so young, so irresponsible. She had never spoken of her family, her home. Who would have suspected the burden she carried so lightly upon her slight shoulders? And on the day he had sent her out to write of the most anything woman she could find in New York, surely there must have been some special reason at home why good space was necessary to her that day. Once he had laughingly called her an Oliver Twist because she was always asking for more space. He suspected she spent large sums for clothes, for she was always smartly dressed with stylish gowns and knobby hats. But the woman of her story made her own dresses and trimmed her hats on Sundays and after midnight. When did the little reporter get time to sleep? From the high window, he looked out again over busy, laughing, soaring, noisy, seething New York, then again at the head of the little reporter still sunk upon her desk, then around upon the men in the room. I expect, he thought, we sometimes forget up here, in our tower of observation, that we too are a part of New York, and perhaps New York also forgets it. We're just a part of it all. And how like we are. How very alike. They were wanting him at his own desk, and he hurried over, yet turning an instant to look again at the little reporter, and said a kindly word to reassure her troubled heart. He saw that her hand had fallen away from her face and that she was fast asleep in the midst of the hubbub of the press room. And he tripped off softly and motioned away young Bobby, the office runner, who was hurrying to her with proofs, lest he should disturb and awaken the woman who was so tired. A Dill Pickle by Catherine Mansfield. And then, after 6 years, she saw him again. He was seated at one of those little bamboo tables decorated with the Japanese vase of paper daffodils. There was a tall plate of fruit in front of him, and very carefully, in a way she recognized immediately as his special way, he was peeling an orange. He must have felt that shock of recognition in her, for he looked up and met her eyes. Incredible. He didn't know her. She smiled. He frowned. She came towards him. He closed his eyes an instant, but opening them, his face lit up as though he had struck a match in a dark room. He laid down the orange and pushed back his chair, and she took her little warm hand out of her muff and gave it to him. Vera, he exclaimed, how strange. Really, for a moment, I didn't know you. Won't you sit down? You've had lunch? Won't you have some coffee? She hesitated. But of course she meant to. Yes, I'd like some coffee. And she sat down opposite him. You've changed. You've changed very much, he said, staring at her with that eager, lighted look. You look so well. I've never seen you look so well before. Really? She raised her veil and unbuttoned her high fur collar. I don't feel very well. I can't bear this weather, you know. Ah, no, you hate the cold. Loathe it, she shuddered. And the worst of it is that the older one grows. He interrupted her. Excuse me, and tapped on the table for the mistress. Please bring some coffee and cream to her. You're sure you won't eat anything? Some fruit, perhaps? The fruit here is very good. No thanks, nothing. Then it's settled. And smiling just a hint too broadly, he took up the orange again. You were saying the older one grows? The colder, she laughed. But she was thinking how well she remembered that trick of his, the trick of interrupting her, and of how it used to exasperate her 6 years ago. She used to feel then as though he, quite suddenly, in the middle of what she was saying, put his hand over her lips, turned from her, attended to something different, and then took his hand away, and with just the same slightly too broad smile, gave her his attention again. "Now we are ready. That is settled." "The colder," he echoed her words, laughing too. "Ah, you still say the same things. And there is another thing about you that has not changed at all. Your beautiful voice. Your beautiful way of speaking." Now he was very grave. He leaned towards her and she smelled the warm, stinging scent of the orange peel. "You have only to say one word and I would know your voice among all other voices. I don't know what it is. I've often wondered. It makes your voice such a haunting memory. Do you remember that afternoon we spent together at Kew Gardens? You were so surprised because I didn't know the names of any flowers. I'm still just as ignorant for all you're telling me. But whenever it is very fine and warm and I see some bright colours, it's awfully strange. I hear your voice saying geranium, marigold, verbena. And I feel those three words are all I recall of some forgotten heavenly language. You remember that afternoon?" "Oh yes, very well." She drew a long, soft breath as though the paper daffodils between them were almost too sweet to bear. Yet, what had remained in her mind of that particular afternoon was an absurd scene over the tea table. A great many people taking tea in a Chinese pagoda, and he behaving like a maniac about the wasps, waving them away, flapping at them with his straw hat, serious and infuriated out of all proportion to the occasion. How delighted the sniggering tea drinkers had been. And how she had suffered. But now, as he spoke, that memory faded. His was the truer. Yes, it had been a wonderful afternoon, full of geranium and marigold and verbena, and warm sunshine. Her thoughts lingered over the last two words as though she sang them. In the warmth, as it were, another memory unfolded. She saw herself sitting on a lawn. He lay beside her, and suddenly, after a long silence, he rolled over and put his head in her lap. "I wish," he said in a low, troubled voice. "I wish that I had taken poison and were about to die, here, now." At that moment, a little girl in a white dress, holding a long, dripping water lily, dodged from behind a bush, stared at them, and dodged back again. But he did not see. She leaned over him. "Ah, why do you say that? I cannot say that." But he gave a kind of soft moan, and taking her hand, he held it to his cheek. "Because I know I'm going to love you too much, far too much. And I shall suffer so terribly, Vera, because you never, never will love me." He was certainly far better looking now than he had been then. He had lost all that dreamy vagueness and indecision. Now he had the air of a man who has found his place in life and fills it with a confidence and an assurance which was, to say the least, impressive. He must have made money, too. His clothes were admirable. And at that moment he pulled a Russian cigarette case out of his pocket. "Won't you smoke?" "Yes, I will." She hovered over them. "They look very good." "I think they are. I get them made for me by a little man in St. James's Street. I don't smoke very much. I'm not like you. But when I do, they must be delicious, very fresh cigarettes. Smoking isn't a habit with me. It's a luxury, like perfume." "Are you still so fond of perfumes?" "Ah, when I was in Russia." She broke in. "You've really been to Russia?" "Oh, yes. I was there for over a year. Have you forgotten how we used to talk of going there?" "No, I haven't forgotten." He gave a strange half laugh and leaned back in his chair. "Isn't it curious? I've really carried out all those journeys that we planned. Yes, I've been to all those places that we talked of and stayed in them long enough to, as you used to say, air oneself in them. In fact, I've spent the last 3 years of my life traveling all the time. Spain, Corsica, Siberia, Russia, Egypt. The only country left is China, and I mean to go there too, when the war is over." As he spoke, so lightly, tapping the end of his cigarette against the ashtray, she felt the strange beast that had slumbered so long within her bosom stir, stretch itself, yawn, prick up its ears, and suddenly bound to its feet, and fix its longing, hungry stare upon those faraway places. But all she said was, smiling gently, "How I envy you." He accepted that. "It has been," he said, "very wonderful, especially Russia." Russia was all that we had imagined, and far, far more. I even spent some days on a river boat on the Volga. Do you remember that boatman's song that you used to play? Yes, it began to play in her mind as she spoke. Do you ever play it now? No, I've no piano. He was amazed at that. What has become of your beautiful piano? She made a little grimace. Sold, ages ago. But you were so fond of music, he wondered. I've no time for it now, said she. He let it go at that. That river life, he went on, is something quite special. After a day or two, you cannot realize that you've ever known another. And it is not necessary to know the language. The life of the boat creates a bond between you and the people that's more than sufficient. You eat with them, pass the day with them, and in the evening there is that endless singing. She shivered, hearing the boatman's song break out again, loud and tragic, and seeing the boat floating on the darkening river with melancholy trees on either side. Yes, I should like that, she said, stroking her muff. You'd like almost everything about Russian life, he said warmly. It's so informal, so impulsive, so free without question. And then the peasants are so splendid. They're such human beings. Yes, that is it. Even the man who drives your carriage has some real part in what is happening. I remember the evening a party of us, two friends of mine and the wife of one of them, went for a picnic by the Black Sea. We took supper and champagne and ate and drank on the grass. And while we were eating, the coachman came up. Have a dill pickle, he said. He wanted to share it with us. That seemed to me so right, so... You know what I mean? And she seemed at that moment to be sitting on the grass beside the mysteriously black sea, black as velvet and rippling against the banks in silent velvet waves. She saw the carriage drawn up to one side of the road and the little group on the grass, their faces and hands white in the moonlight. She saw the pale dress of the woman outspread and her folded parasol lying on the grass like a huge pearl crochet hook. Apart from them, with his supper and a cloth on his knees, sat the coachman. "Have a dill pickle," said he. And although she was not certain what a dill pickle was, she saw the greenish glass jar with a red chili like a parrot's beak glimmering through. She sucked in her cheeks. The dill pickle was terribly sour. "Yes, I know perfectly what you mean," she said. In the pause that followed, they looked at each other. In the past, when they had looked at each other like that, they had felt such a boundless understanding between them that their souls had, as it were, put their arms around each other and dropped into the same sea, content to be drowned, like mournful lovers. But now, the surprising thing was that it was he who held back. He who said, "What a marvelous listener you are. When you look at me with those wild eyes, I feel that I could tell you things that I would never breathe to another human being." Was there just a hint of mockery in his voice, or was it her fancy? She could not be sure. "Before I met you," he said, "I'd never spoken of myself to anybody. How well I remember one night, the night that I brought you the little Christmas tree, telling you all about my childhood, and of how I was so miserable that I ran away and lived under a cart in our yard for 2 days without being discovered. And you listened, and your eyes shone, and I felt that you had even made the little Christmas tree listen too, as in a fairy story." But of that evening she'd remembered a little pot of caviar. It had cost 7 and 6 pence. He could not get over it. Think of it. A tiny jar like that costing 7 and 6 pence. While she ate it, he watched her, delighted and shocked. No, really, that is eating money. You could not get 7 shillings into a little pot that size. Only think of the profit they must make. And he had begun some immensely complicated calculations. But now, goodbye to the caviar. The Christmas tree was on the table, and the little boy lay under the cart with his head pillowed on the yard dog. "The dog was called Bosun," she cried delightedly. But he did not follow. "Which dog? Had you a dog? I don't remember a dog at all." "No, no, I meant the yard dog when you were a little boy." He laughed and snapped the cigarette case. Was he? Do you know I'd forgotten that? It seemed such ages ago. I cannot believe that it was only 6 years. After I'd recognized you today, I had to take such a leap. I had to take a leap over my whole life to get back to that time. I was such a kid then. He drummed on the table. I've often thought how I must have bored you. And now I understand so perfectly why you wrote to me as you did. Although at the time that letter nearly finished my life. I found it again the other day. And I couldn't help laughing as I read it. It was so clever, such a true picture of me. He glanced up. You're not going? She had buttoned her collar again and drawn down her veil. Yes, I'm afraid I must, she said, and managed a smile. Now she knew that he had been mocking. Ah, no, please, he pleaded. Don't go just for a moment. And he caught up one of her gloves from the table and clutched at it, as if that would hold her. I see so few people to talk to nowadays that I've turned into a sort of barbarian, he said. Have I said something to hurt you? Not a bit, she lied. But as she watched him draw her glove through his fingers, gently, gently, her anger really did die down. And besides, at the moment he looked more like himself of 6 years ago. What I really wanted then, he said softly, was to be a sort of carpet. To make myself into a sort of carpet for you to walk on so that you need not be hurt by the sharp stones and mud that you hated so. It was nothing more positive than that, nothing more selfish. Only I did desire, eventually, to turn into a magic carpet and carry you away to all those lands you longed to see. As he spoke, she lifted her head as though she drank something. The strange beast in her bosom began to purr. I felt that you were more lonely than anybody else in the world, he went on, and yet perhaps that you were the only person in the world who was really, truly alive. Born out of your time, he murmured, stroking the glove. Fated. Ah, God, what had she done? How had she dared to throw away her happiness like this? This was the only man who had ever understood her. Was it too late? Could it be too late? She was that glove that he held in his fingers. And then the fact that you had no friends and never had made friends with people. How I understood that, for neither had I. Is it just the same now? Yes, she breathed, just the same. I am as alone as ever. So am I, he laughed gently, just the same. Suddenly, with a quick gesture, he handed her back the glove and scraped his chair on the floor. What seemed to me so mysterious then is perfectly plain to me now. And to you, too, of course. It simply was that we were such egoists, so self-engrossed, so wrapped up in ourselves that we hadn't a corner in our hearts for anybody else. Do you know, he cried, naive and hearty, and dreadfully like another side of that old self again. I began studying a mind system when I was in Russia, and I found that we were not peculiar at all. It's quite a well-known form of... She had gone. He sat there, thunderstruck, astounded beyond words. And then he asked the waitress for his bill. But the cream has not been touched, he said. Please, do not charge me for it. The Enchanted Bluff by Willa Cather. We had our swim before sundown, and while we were cooking our supper, the oblique rays of light made a dazzling glare on the white sand about us. The translucent red ball itself sank behind the brown stretches of cornfield as we sat down to eat, and the warm layer of air that had rested over the water and our clean sand bar grew fresher and smelled of the rank ironweed and sunflowers growing on the flatter shore. The river was brown and sluggish, like any other of the half-dozen streams that water the Nebraska cornlands. On one shore was an irregular line of bold clay bluffs, where a few scrub oaks with thick trunks and flat twisted tops threw light shadows on the long grass. The western shore was low and level, with cornfields that stretched to the skyline, and all along the water's edge were little sandy coves and beaches where slim cottonwoods and willow saplings flickered. The turbulence of the river in springtime discouraged milling, and beyond keeping the old red bridge in repair, the busy farmers did not concern themselves with the stream, so the Sandtown boys were left in undisputed possession. In the autumn, we hunted quail through the miles of stubble and fodder land along the flat shore, and, after the winter skating season was over and the ice had gone out, the spring freshets and flooded bottoms gave us our great excitement of the year. The channel was never the same for two successive seasons. Every spring, the swollen stream undermined a bluff to the east or bit out a few acres of cornfield to the west and whirled the soil away, to deposit it in spumy mud banks somewhere else. When the water fell low in midsummer, new sandbars were thus exposed to dry and whiten in the August sun. Sometimes these were banked so firmly that the fury of the next freshet failed to unseat them. The little willow seedlings emerged triumphantly from the yellow froth, broke into spring leaf, shot up into summer growth, and with their mesh of roots bound together, the moist sand beneath them against the batterings of another April. Here and there, a cottonwood soon glittered among them, quivering in the low current of the air that, even on breathless days, when the dust hung like smoke above the wagon road, trembled along the face of the water. It was on such an island, in the third summer of its yellow green, that we built our watchfire, not in the thicket of the dancing willow wands, but on the level terrace of fine sand which had been added that spring, a little new bit of world, beautifully ridged with ripple marks and strewn with the tiny skeletons of turtles and fish, all as white and dry as if they had been expertly cured. We had been careful not to mar the freshness of the place, although we often swam to it on summer evenings and lay on the sand to rest. This was our last watchfire of the year, and there were reasons why I should remember it better than any of the others. Next week, the other boys were to file back to their old places in the Sandtown High School, but I was to go up to the Divide to teach my first country school in the Norwegian district. I was already homesick at the thought of quitting the boys with whom I'd always played, of leaving the river, and going up into a windy plain that was all windmills and cornfields and big pastures, where there was nothing willful or unmanageable in the landscape. No new islands, and no chance of unfamiliar birds, such as often followed the watercourses. Other boys came and went and used the river for fishing or skating, but we six were sworn to the spirit of the stream, and we were friends mainly because of the river. There were the two Hassler boys, Fritz and Otto, sons of the little German tailor. They were the youngest of us, rugged boys of 10 and 12 with sunburned hair, weather-stained faces and pale blue eyes. Otto, the elder, was the best mathematician in school and clever at his books, but he always dropped out in the spring term as if the river could not get on without him. He and Fritz caught the fat horned catfish and sold them about the town, and they lived so much in the water that they were as brown and sandy as the river itself. There was Percy Pound, a fat freckled boy with chubby cheeks, who took half a dozen boys' story papers and was always being kept in for reading detective stories behind his desk. There was Tip Smith, destined by his freckles and red hair to be the buffoon in all our games, though he walked like a timid little old man and had a funny cracked laugh. Tip worked hard in his father's grocery store every afternoon and swept it out before school in the morning. Even his recreations were laborious. He collected cigarette cards and tin tobacco tags indefatigably and would sit for hours humped over a snarling little scroll saw which he kept in his attic. His dearest possessions were some little pill bottles that purported to contain grains of wheat from the Holy Land, water from the Jordan and the Dead Sea, and earth from the Mountain of Olives. His father had bought these dull things from a Baptist missionary who peddled them, and Tip seemed to derive great satisfaction from their remote origin. The tall boy was Arthur Adams. He had fine hazel eyes that were almost too reflective and sympathetic for a boy, and such a pleasant voice that we all loved to hear him read aloud. Even when he had to read poetry aloud at school, no one ever thought of laughing. To be sure, he was not at school very much at the time. He was 17 and would have finished the high school the year before, but he was always off somewhere with his gun. Arthur's mother was dead, and his father, who was feverishly absorbed in promoting schemes, wanted to send the boy away to school and get him off his hands. But Arthur always begged off for another year and promised to study. I remember him as a tall boy with an intelligent face, always lounging among a lot of us little fellows, laughing at us oftener than with us, but such a soft, satisfied laugh that we felt rather flattered when we provoked it. In after years, people said that Arthur had been given to evil ways as a lad, and it is true that we often saw him with the gambler's sons and with old Spanish Fanny's boy, but if he learned anything ugly in their company, he never betrayed it to us. We would have followed Arthur anywhere, and I am bound to say that he led us into no worse places than the cattail marshes and the stubble fields. These, then, were the boys who camped with me that summer night upon the sandbar. After we finished our supper, we beat the willow thicket for driftwood. By the time we had collected enough, night had fallen, and the pungent, weedy smell from the shore increased with the coolness. We threw ourselves down about the fire and made another futile attempt to show Piercy Pound the Little Dipper. We had tried it often before, but he could never be got past the big one. "You see those three big stars just below the handle, with the bright one in the middle?" said Otto Hassler. "That's Orion's belt, and the bright one is the clasp." I crawled behind Otto's shoulder and sighted up his arm to the star that seemed perched upon the tip of his steady forefinger. The Hassler boys did sand fishing at night, and they knew a good many stars. Percy gave up the Little Dipper and lay back on the sand, his hands clasped under his head. "I can see the North Star," he announced contentedly, pointing toward it with his big toe. "Anyone might get lost and need to know that." We all looked up at it. "How do you suppose Columbus felt when his compass didn't point north anymore?" Tip asked. Otto shook his head. "My father says that there was another North Star once, and that maybe this one won't last always. I wonder what would happen to us down here if anything went wrong with it." Arthur chuckled. "I wouldn't worry, Ott. Nothing's apt to happen to it in our time. Look at the Milky Way." We lay back and looked, meditating at the dark cover of the world. The gurgle of the water had become heavier. We had often noticed a mutinous, complaining tone in it at night, quite different from its cheerful daytime chuckle, and seeming like the voice of a much deeper and more powerful stream. Our water had always these two moods, the one of sunny complacence, the other of inconsolable, passionate regret. "Strange how the stars are all in sort of diagrams," remarked Otto. "You could do most any proposition in geometry with them. They always look as if they meant something. Some folks say everybody's fortune is all written out in the stars, don't they?" "They also believe in the old country," Fritz affirmed. But Arthur only laughed at him. "You're thinking of Napoleon, Fritzy. He had a star that went out when he began to lose battles. I guess the stars don't keep any close tally on Sandtown folks." We were speculating on how many times we could count 100 before the evening star went down behind the cornfields, when someone cried, "There comes the moon, and it's as big as a cartwheel." We all jumped up to greet it as it swam over the bluffs behind us. It came up like a galleon in full sail, an enormous barbaric thing, red as an angry heathen god. "When the moon came up red like that, the Aztecs used to sacrifice their prisoners on the temple top," Percy announced. "Go on, Pierce. You got that out of golden days. Do you believe that, Arthur?" I appealed. Arthur answered quite seriously. "Like as not. The moon was one of their gods. When my father was in Mexico City, he saw the stone where they used to sacrifice their prisoners." As we dropped down by the fire again, someone asked whether the mound builders were older than the Aztecs. "When we once got upon the mound builders, we never willingly got away from them. And we were still conjecturing when we heard a loud splash in the water." "Must have been a big cat jumping," said Fritz. "They do sometimes. They must see bugs in the dark. Look what a track the moon makes." There was a long silvery streak on the water, and where the current fretted over a big log, it boiled up like gold pieces. "Suppose there ever was any gold hid away in this old river?" Fritz asked. He lay close to the fire, his chin on his hand and his bare feet in the air. His brother laughed at him, but Arthur took his suggestion seriously. Some of the Spaniards thought there was gold up here somewhere. 7 cities chuck full of gold, they had it. And Coronado and his men came up to hunt it. The Spaniards were all over this country once. Percy looked interested. Was that before the Mormons went through? We all laughed at this. Long enough before. Before the Pilgrim Fathers, Pierce. Maybe they came along this very river. They always followed the watercourses. I wonder where this river really does begin, Tip mused. That was an old and favorite mystery which the map did not clearly explain. On the map, the little black line stopped somewhere in western Kansas, but since rivers generally rose in mountains, it was only reasonable to suppose that ours came from the Rockies. Its destination, we knew, was the Missouri, and the Hasler boys always maintained that we could embark at Sandtown in flood time, follow their noses, and eventually arrive at New Orleans. Now, they took up their old argument. If us boys could grit enough to try it, it wouldn't take no time to get to Kansas City and St. Joe. We began to talk about the places we wanted to go to. The Hasler boys wanted to see the stockyards in Kansas City, and Percy wanted to see a big store in Chicago. Arthur was interlocutor and did not betray himself. Now it's your turn, Tip. Tip rolled over on his elbow and poked the fire, and his eyes looked shyly out of his strange, tight little face. My place is awful far away. My Uncle Bill told me about it. Tip's Uncle Bill was a wanderer, bitten with mining fever, who had drifted into Sandtown with a broken arm, and when it was well, had drifted out again. Where is it? Ah, it's down in New Mexico somewheres. There aren't no railroads or anything. You have to go on mules, and you run out of water before you get there, and have to drink canned tomatoes. Well, go on, kid. What's it like when you do get there? Tip sat up and excitedly began his story. There's a big red rock there that goes right up out of the sand for about 900 feet. The country's flat all around it, and this here rock goes up all by itself like a monument. They call it the Enchanted Bluff down there. The sides are smooth rock and straight up like a wall. The Indians say that hundreds of years ago, before the Spaniards came, there was a village away up there in the air. The tribe that lived there had some sort of steps made out of wood and bark. Bung down over the face of the bluff, and the braves went down to hunt and carried water up in big jars swung on their backs. They kept a big supply of water and dried meat up there, and never went down except to hunt. They were a peaceful tribe that made cloth and pottery, and they went out there to get out of the wars. You see, they could pick off any war party that tried to get up their little steps. The Indians say they were a handsome people, and they had some sort of strange religion. Uncle Bill thinks they were cliff dwellers who had got into trouble and left home. They weren't fighters anyhow. One time, the braves were down hunting and an awful storm came up, a kind of waterspout, and when they got back to their rock, they found their little staircase had been all broken to pieces, and only a few steps were left hanging away up in the air. While they were camped at the foot of the rock, wondering what to do, a war party from the north came along and massacred them to a man, with all the old folks and women looking on from the rock. Then the war party went on south and left the village to get down the best way they could. Of course, they never got down. They starved to death up there. And when the war party came back on their way north, they heard the children crying from the edge of the bluff where they had crawled out. But they didn't see a sign of a grown Indian, and nobody has ever been up there since. We exclaimed at this dolorous legend and sat up. There couldn't have been many people up there, Percy demurred. How big is the top, Tip? Oh, pretty big. Big enough so that the rock doesn't look nearly as tall as it is. The top's bigger than the base. The bluff is sort of worn away for several hundred feet up. That's one reason it's so hard to climb. I asked how the Indians got up in the first place. Nobody knows how they got up or when. A hunting party came along once and saw that there was a town up there, and that was all. Otto rubbed his chin and looked thoughtful. Of course, there must have been some way to get up there. Couldn't people get a rope over some way and pull a ladder up? Tip's little eyes were shining with excitement. I know a way. Me and Uncle Bill talked it over. There's a kind of rocket that could take a rope over, lifesavers use them. And then you could hoist a rope ladder and peg it down at the bottom and make it tight with ropes on the other side. I'm going to climb that there bluff, and I've got it all planned out. Fritz asked what he expected to find when he got up there. Bones, maybe, or the ruins of their town, or pottery, or some of their idols. There might be most anything up there. Anyhow, I want to see. Sure nobody else has been up there, Tip? Arthur asked. Dead sure. Hardly anybody ever goes down there. Some hunters tried to cut steps in the rock once, but they didn't get higher than a man can reach. The bluff's all red granite, and Uncle Bill thinks it's a boulder the glaciers left. It's a strange place, anyhow. Nothing but cactus and desert for hundreds of miles, and yet right under the bluff there's good water and plenty of grass. That's why the bison used to go down there. Suddenly, we heard a scream above our fire and jumped up to see a dark, slim bird floating southward far above us. A whooping crane. We knew her by her cry and her long neck. We ran to the edge of the island, hoping we might see her alight, but she wavered southward along the river course until we lost her. The Hasler boys declared that by the look of the heavens it must be after midnight, so we threw more wood on our fire, put on our jackets, and curled down in the warm sand. Several of us pretended to doze, but I fancy we were really thinking about Tip's Bluff and the extinct people. Over in the wood, the ring doves were calling mournfully to one another, and once we heard a dog bark far away. "Somebody getting into old Tommy's melon patch," Fritz murmured sleepily, but nobody answered him. By and by, Percy spoke out of the shadows. "Say, Tip, when you go down there, will you take me with you?" "Maybe." "Suppose one of us beats you down there, Tip." "Whoever gets to the bluff first has got to promise to tell the rest of us exactly what he finds," remarked one of the Hassel boys. And to this, we all readily assented. Somewhat reassured, I dropped off to sleep. I must have dreamed about a race for the bluff, for I woke in a kind of fear that other people were getting ahead of me and that I was losing my chance. I sat up in my damp clothes and looked at the other boys who lay tumbled in uneasy attitudes about the dead fire. It was still dark, but the sky was blue with the last wonderful azure of night. The stars glistened like crystal globes and trembled as if they shone through a depth of clear water. Even as I watched, they began to pale and the sky brightened. Day came suddenly, almost instantaneously. I turned for another look at the blue night, and it was gone. Everywhere the birds began to call, and all manner of little insects began to chirp and hop about in the willows. A breeze sprang up from the west and brought the heavy smell of ripened corn. The boys rolled over and shook themselves. We stripped and plunged into the river just as the sun came up over the windy bluffs. When I came home to Sandtown at Christmas time, we skated out to our island and talked over the whole project of the Enchanted Bluff, renewing our resolution to find it. Although that was 20 years ago, none of us have ever climbed the Enchanted Bluff. Percy Pound is a stockbroker in Kansas City and will go nowhere that his red touring car cannot carry him. Otto Hasler went on the railroad and lost his foot braking, after which he and Fritz succeeded their father as the town tailors. Arthur sat about the sleepy town all his life. He died before he was 25. The last time I saw him, when I was home on one of my college vacations, he was sitting in a steamer chair under a cottonwood tree in the little yard behind one of the two Sandtown saloons. He was very untidy, and his hand was not steady, but when he rose, unabashed, to greet me, his eyes were as clear and warm as ever. When I had talked with him for an hour and heard him laugh again, I wondered how it was that, when nature had taken such pains with a man, from his hands to the arch of his long foot, she had ever lost him in Sandtown. He joked about Tip Smith's bluff and declared he was going down there just as soon as the weather got cooler. He thought the Grand Canyon might be worthwhile too. I was perfectly sure, when I left him, that he would never get beyond the high plank fence and the comfortable shade of the cottonwood. And indeed, it was under that very tree that he died one summer morning. Tip Smith still talks about going to New Mexico, He married a slatternly, unthrifty country girl, has been much tied to a perambulator, and has grown stooped and grey from irregular meals and broken sleep. But the worst of his difficulties are now over, and he has, as he says, come into easy water. When I was last in Sandtown, I walked home with him late one moonlight night, after he had balanced his cash and shut up his store. We took the long way around and sat down on the schoolhouse steps, and between us we quite revived the romance of the lone red rock and the extinct people. Tip insists that he still means to go down there, but he thinks now he will wait until his boy Bert is old enough to go with him. Bert has been let into the story and thinks of nothing but the Enchanted Bluff. Good night.